Very, very warm welcome back, everyone. So good to be together, and why don't we continue our journey together with a few thoughts on the first part of Book 2 of the Psalter. So let's just make a few general comments and then move into a discussion of Psalms 42 to 55. I'll try to say at least a brief word about each. But first, just a couple comments by way of orientation to this particular segment. As we were glancing through our textbooks, we probably noticed some early remarks that our editors make. In the past, you could say that the Psalms were predominantly studied as individual compositions. So folks were concerned about the genre, perhaps, where it fit in Israel's liturgical calendar, or even devotional readings that took various elements from one psalm or another and aimed to comfort and to edify the believing community. What we notice almost from the opening paragraph of our textbooks is that the Psalter is read more and more these days as a coherent and unified book, or at least scholars continue to probe that particular dimension. So I think you could say that that's a fairly significant shift. As one of the editors puts it, this shift is concerned in a lot of ways with the overall message of the Psalter, which may have been less of a priority for earlier interpreters. So scholars are concerned with the overall message of the Book of Psalms as a book, as a literary and canonical entity, reading from early in one of the textbooks, that coheres with respect to its structure and, as a result, its message. Regardless of the authorship and the place and the source of origin of various individual psalms, or even the prehistory of earlier collections that may have been grouped within the Psalter, these were eventually collected into a canonical book, and a lot of studies nowadays consider this overall structure and how they fit together and the storyline that runs through Psalms 1 all the way to 150. So we started last time with an exploration of Book 1 and wondering how it fit together and if there was a particular element or time frame within Israel's history that may have been prioritized in those first 41 Psalms. One possibility that we were probing involves whether or not Book 1 provides a perspective on the earlier days in the monarchy. So in other words, what we're getting is a poetic angle and theological reflections on the early days of kingship and the various crises that came along with it and how people would respond to these crises through prayer and through corporate praise. And that's why we notice a whole host of various exigencies and situations that seem to be in the backstory of a number of the Psalms, whether it's in Book 1, that is, with threats or pretty aggressive enemies. Verbal slander, it seems like some of the Psalms in Book 1 presuppose military attacks or corruption in the capital city, or bitterness from maybe someone who's been marginalized. Lament, and we'll talk more about this down the road, but if you think of books 1 to 3 in this five-act drama of the Psalter, lament is much more common in the first three books than it is in the last two, so we'll have to continue to consider that. We see various wrestlings with idolatries, with despair and confusion. Now, all of that is often juxtaposed. There can be moments of celebration. There can be cries to trust God in new ways and figure out exactly how to do that. And there also can be commemorations of corporate or individual rescue. I think what we can be sure about as we glance through Book 1 is that even when you're under the umbrella of God's promise, it does not guarantee immunity from the darker powers of this world. And what I think altogether we hear in Book 1 is a chorus of voices that declare words that range from reorienting praise to nuanced critique of the prevailing order. Now, it was probably obvious from your own glance through Book 1 that we're not dealing with an exact chronology here. Instead, what you could probably think about is a kaleidoscope or even a collage of images that go back and forth in time to provide a vision on a longer era. Okay, so we go back and forth in specific time in order to shed light on a particular phase in Israel's history. So rather than something that's strictly linear, what we get is almost an elliptical poetic experience. Now, I know many of you are kind of into popular TV and ways of communicating with our culture and understanding our dominant cultural narrative, and of course TVs and movies are part of that. Oftentimes, movies and TV shows nowadays feature time-splitting, or back and forth, or flashbacks, don't they? And it's not always announced. It's up to the reader to kind of figure this out, and the best TV shows, of course, can do that, and not make it so obscure that, of course, you get lost and you flip the channel, because that's the last thing the screenwriters want. And don't be cynical here. I know some of you are going to say, oh yeah, it's interesting. You go into some of our churches nowadays and it seems like 1971 at the latest. No, that's not quite what we're talking about. Although efforts to reboot a modern hymn with a postmodern hip-hop beat, might be something of what we're seeing in part of Book One. But for the most part, and more generally, I think what we're seeing is snapshots of the turbulence that's so often associated with the early monarchy, and cries for relief during difficult circumstances. And probably keep these things in mind, because either way, however we're interpreting the final collection, themes earlier in the Psalter will be continued and expanded later as the collection unfolds, regardless of how we might finally interpret it. Here's a few words from Gerald Wilson in his particular essay. The first three books of the Psalter, in his view, focus on the Davidic covenant, its introduction in divine grace, its transmission to David's successors with hope, and then its collapse and the destruction and the despair of the exile. So did you notice? That's actually the first three books in miniature. The introduction to the Davidic covenant, book one, transmission to the successors, book two, and then the collapse, that would be the focus on book three. Overall, Wilson concludes that the Psalms and Psalm collections of the Hebrew Bible were arranged to tell the story of the rise and fall of Davidic kingship in Israel. That's the first three books. And then the story of new hope for existence with God as king in the exilic and post-exilic period, and that would be books four and five. How does Wilson close? Well, the closing words of his book, whether or not this is replicated exactly in the essay, his closing words are this: Yahweh is the eternal king, and only he is ultimately worthy of trust. Human princes will wither and fade like grass, but the steadfast love of the Lord endures forever. Let's transition now then to look at Book 2 and some of the individual compositions. And we've probably already had a slight orientation by having a look already at Psalm 42, just by way of follow-up. Psalm 3, as we recall, kind of the first dramatic psalm in Book 1, we have Psalms 1 and 2 that you and I are calling the gateway, and then Psalm 3 immediately plunges you and I as readers, as worshipers, into the king's crisis and into the really dismal situation associated with Absalom's rebellion. So just like Psalm 3 plunges us into the king's crisis in the opening moments of Book 1, so Psalm 42 similarly transports us into the world, as it were, of Book 2, the key time frame. And Psalm 42 almost has this exilic anticipation, if not actuality. It's almost like there's a exilic melody that you can hear from the outset and the opening cadences of Psalm 42, the first of Book 2. As we mentioned, it's one of the Psalms of Korah, Sons of Korah. We'll hear more from this band. They'll have a few hits in Book 3, and if Psalms of the Sons of Korah have the highest percentage of mention of Sheol, I think we can probably say it's a reasonable guess to see Psalms from the band the Sons of Korah in Book 3 of the Psalter, much like we see them strategically placed at various points in Book 2. I think I might have mentioned Charles Spurgeon, the great Victorian preacher, already, but he's really into Psalm 42 and has some good insights about the Sons of Korah, this band of singers, this popular music group in the era of the temple. Spurgeon reminds us that they'd been spared when their father and all his company and all the children of his associates were swallowed up alive in their sin in Numbers 26:11. They, that is, the surviving sons of Korah, were the spared ones of sovereign grace, preserved, we know not why, says Spurgeon, by the distinguishing favor of God. And it may be surmised that after their remarkable election to mercy, they became so filled with gratitude that they addicted themselves to sacred music. Isn't that beautiful? Addicted themselves to sacred music. We live in a society that is rife with addiction. Why don't we have better ones addicted to sacred music, right out of Spurgeon's commentary on Psalm 42 right here? In order that, so it's not just an addiction for addiction's sake, in order that their spared lives might be consecrated to the glory of God. At any rate, Spurgeon concludes, we who have been rescued as they were from going down into the pit out of the mere good pleasure of the Lord can heartily join in this psalm, and indeed in all the songs which show forth the praises of our God and the pantings of our hearts after him, of course, as the deer pants for the water. So finally then, Psalm 42 opens with a poet who seems to be far away from the temple, far away from the city of Jerusalem. So perhaps that's a bit of an exilic overture here at the beginning of Book 2, and we'll have to see what other compositions in the psalm might propel us in either that or some other direction. Psalm 43, you'll notice right from the outset, has no superscription, and a lot of interpreters understand it as a continuation of Psalm 42 and exact paragraph repetitions. Why are you downcast, O my soul, for example, seems to buttress that case. Sometimes a band will have a song, and then in a live performance, they'll have an elongated version or something with a new riff. For example, Pearl Jam, one year in Budapest, was riffing on one of their signature hits, and all of a sudden, the lead singer, Eddie, burst into Frozen. That's right, Let It Go. Bit of a crass analogy, and I'm going to try to cultivate my addiction to sacred music, but the idea of a familiar psalm then having an extra chorus or an extra bridge or two, an extra stanza, may not have been all that unfamiliar in the history of Israel's musical compositions. Either way, there's some points of thematic continuity with Psalm 42. In both, we have the oppression by a hostile nation, probably some sort of superpower, maybe. In both, it's like the poet is longing for the altar of Jerusalem. And don't forget, the altar is where you seek forgiveness, reconnection with God. And like Psalm 42, what we have is a question of dealing with inner turmoil that comes primarily from external circumstances. Sometimes, of course, we have inner turmoil based on our own bad choices and even disposition at times, but sometimes that turmoil is caused by something outside of ourselves. And it looks as though, as far as Psalms 42 and 43 are concerned, that seems to be more of the case. Longer than both Psalms 42 and 43 put together is, of course, Psalm 44. And as you have a look through, it seems that there's a setting of national defeat here, where the nation has been attacked and an opponent has prevailed, and as a result, there's a certain melancholy. In some ways, it kind of reminds me of Gideon in Judges chapter 6. As you recall in that story, Gideon is threshing wheat in a wine press to hide it from the Midianites, who of course have been ravaging and pillaging the nation. In Judges, of course, what we have is this undulation, this cycle. Israel serves God for a while and then sells out and serves foreign deities and ironically become enslaved, usually by the very nation whose deities they have been enticed by. Gideon is threshing wheat in a wine press to hide it from the Midianites, and he's greeted by a messenger of God. The Lord be with you, O mighty warrior. Yeah, right, Gideon says sarcastically. If God's with us, then why have all these miserable things befallen us? Oh yeah, I've heard the stories of our ancestors about how God brought us up out of Egypt, but now God has abandoned us. Now we've been sold into the grip of Midian. Isn't that the sense of national defeat? And just as the messenger of the Lord tries to provide an alternative perspective to Gideon, well, perhaps the poet of Psalm 44 has a similar goal. In this prayer that's a call for God to restore, perhaps, the fortunes of the chosen people. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and the podcaster? Is that the right word for it? Anyway, the speaker on this particular podcast was going on and on about this song that meant a lot to him because, quote, this song was played at my wedding. So it seems to me you could probably come up with a genre of the wedding song. We have wedding singers. I think you could have a movie called The Wedding Songs, something like that. Why on earth would I waste this precious podcast time to tell you that, if not because Psalm 45 is often considered to be within the genre of the royal wedding hymn. And you glance through it, and it seems like there's a certain plausibility as far as those interpreters that make that argument. A royal wedding hymn in Book 2 is an interesting placement for it, because there's a lot of kings in the history of Israel who multiplied wives and often went on the website foreignmatch.com and found wives from among the nations, of which, of course, Moses and Deuteronomy said, don't do. In Psalm 45, there's a reminder that, you know, blessings corporately flow when a nation prioritizes the Torah. Psalm 45 is early still in Book 2, right? If Book 2 is talking about the era once Jerusalem's been established as the capital city and various turbulence associated with that, it might be a reminder that there's still time. Even if the king goes astray, it doesn't mean the nation has to follow suit, and can in fact encourage the king to come back, to get back on course after a season of waywardness. So, Psalm 45 may well be within the genre of a royal wedding song. My favorite verse, personally, is verse 12. The daughter of Tyre will come with a gift. People of wealth will seek your favor. Tyre, of course, the richest place, probably per square foot, in the history of humanity, and yet it's mentioned in the book of Acts. In a very exciting place, there's a church there. Even though it was so wealthy, there's something about the good news that's greater than all the accumulated gold and silver in the history of the city of Tyre. So that's one of my favorite verses in Psalm 45 because of its intertext with Acts chapter 21, verse 6. Speaking of movies that have been made out of books, there's been a couple of iterations of the movie Journey to the Center of the Earth, of course, based on the Jules Verne classic. What is the center of the earth, in your opinion? Well, for most biblical writers, the center of the earth is in the city of Jerusalem. The center of the earth is in the Jerusalem temple. The exact center of the earth, and in fact the center of the entire cosmos itself, is the most holy place in the Jerusalem temple. The poet of Psalm 46 is inviting readers to consider this place and consider the blessings that flow from the great river of God, which is the kind of spatial centerpiece, I suppose, of that city, and it's here in Psalm 46. And speaking of Psalm 46, it comes right before Psalm 47, which frankly is one of my favorite. I've got a soft spot for this psalm. My first publication ever on the Psalms, sort of a personal shout-out here, came from One of the last lines of Psalm 47, I was asked by a church in Toronto to preach on this passage, which I immediately regretted upon saying yes to the assignment and read the psalm, because I couldn't really find 3 points. I had no clever illustrations. I couldn't think of a skit to go along with it. But what I did notice is that the NIV translation of verse 9 may not have been the final word. NIV translation of verse 9, the nobles of the nations assemble as the people of the God of Abraham, for the kings of the earth belong to God, he is greatly exalted. Now, that's, I think, a fair rendering, but I was wondering if it's not possible to translate it this way. The princes, the nobles, the aristocracy of the nations will assemble, oh, people of the God of Abraham. Why? Because the kings of the earth belong to God, who is greatly exalted. So what I was suggesting is that the people of the God of Abraham, in the second part of verse 9, should be translated as evocative, because this is almost a testimony, an anticipation of a universal victory and acclamation, and a reminder that the promise to Abraham, which may have been forgotten in the heady days of the glitzy monarchy, would, in fact, come to pass. Here's a call to worship with the reminder that one day everybody will worship. Oh, yes, and you ought to keep this in mind, oh, people of the God of Abraham. That's why I called that article a provocative option. Provocative? I was arguing in favor of the... It really wasn't a bestseller and didn't get a whole lot of traction. I wonder why. In Psalm 48, we seem to get the sense that there's escalating conflict. And yet, in the midst of this, the city of Jerusalem is celebrated. Some scholars refer to this sequence of, or as a sequence, as part of a group of enthronement psalms. And Psalm 48 links the city of Jerusalem with God's promise. Neither can ever be finally demolished by hostile nations, okay? So the city of Jerusalem can be battered and even bulldozed to the ground, but not permanently destroyed. And it's the same thing with God's promise. There is a durability that will outlast even the most hostile and aggressive attack, and even the most lazy and apathetic indifference. Right in the middle of Psalm 48 is a groovy reference to the ships of Tarshish. Yeah, these were like the Titanics of the ancient world. No one, not even God, can sink these ships. Tarshish, of course, is understood as sort of the ends of the earth full of glamorous treasures, and therefore these boats are powerful. They're capable of long journeys. They represent the highest achievement of naval technology, but they will not finally endure. And again, this is a composition by the sons of Korah, and they sort of know what it's like to take on a divine promise or something that's anointed and not quite make it out alive. Fun fact about Psalm 49, it's a wisdom psalm where God is not addressed as such. What we have instead is a human audience who are being told not to be envious of wealth. Even with the greatest hoard of wealth, it's hard to pay your own ransom, as it were. Back in the days of Solomon, I'm thinking of 1 Kings 10:27, the king was so rich that silver was as common in Jerusalem as pebbles. My goodness. Yeah, I'd have to think, was Psalm 49 composed during that era? Could Solomon have actually heard this one day in the temple? Oh boy, the sons of Korah, they're a cheeky little music group, aren't they? Funny, can music rebuke the powerful? Can music be a word of, or provide a voice of protest and of critique of the reigning establishment? Well, who knows, but those are the lyrics of Psalm 49. Now, hey, do me a solid, as Kramer used to say. What do you notice about just the very, very beginning of Psalm 50? Compare it with the very, very beginning of Psalm 49. All of a sudden, Psalm 50, what do you have? You've got a prayer of Asaph. And it's true. It's the first time statistically that the name Asaph has been mentioned in the Psalter. And there will be at least a dozen more psalms that carry some sort of copyright or connection with the group organized by Asaph in the time of David, and then it seems to be kind of like the Newsboys, different lead singers, perhaps different iterations of band members, but the band plays on, as it were. It's funny, later in 2 Chronicles, Asaph is almost given the title of a great seer, a great person of insight. And it's funny that you almost get a prophetic word here in Psalm 50. Right after a warning about falsely trusting in wealth, the entire community is warned to keep the terms of the covenant in what certainly sounds like a prophetic oracle of judgment. It carries with it the tone and the imagery of a lawsuit, and I suppose deep down it's a reminder that the people can likewise be guilty. If the king wanders astray, yes, there's going to be elements of misery in your own life, but you too will be held accountable for your individual actions. So, Psalm 50, perhaps in that vein. And we know full well that kings can wander astray, because that is the subject matter of Psalm 51, which you can hear about elsewhere. Just one quick question, really, on this. Why does it end Psalm 51? Again, you can listen to sermons about this if you like. I want to know why, at least in most translations, Psalm 51 ends with the image of a young bull being offered on the altar. Any idea why that might be? Well, here's a hint. In terms of the value scale of offerings, a young bull would have been the most expensive creature that you can offer. The most expensive blood offering has got to be a young bull, because those are valuable. That's like taking a Cybertruck and throwing it in the dumpster. That's like breaking all its windows and... I think you get my point. This is a really valuable sacrifice, and I wonder if it's a poignant image with which to end Psalm 51. You can think about the sermons, you can think about that image as you reflect on this particular composition. Psalm 52 likewise evokes an image from the Davidic monarchy, Doeg the Edomite. Doeg is a hired foreign hitman in the court of Saul. He's basically a hired assassin. Doeg the Edomite. The Edomites, of course, are antagonists to Jerusalem and the progenitors of a great deal of woe toward the city itself. So it's interesting that you get this kind of foreign big shot as a character in Psalm 52, perhaps suggesting that even if Psalm 2 is dealing with some later issue, things that were dealt with or things that happened, things that were experienced in the time of the Davidic court, continue to be recycled in the era of the monarchy in a whole bunch of different ways. So a certain rhetorical effect, I think, to the mention of Doeg the Edomite. Take 5 seconds and have a quick read of Psalm 53. It won't take very long, because you've already read a lot of it in Psalm 14. Now, what's up with that? A lot of similarities between the two. Maybe some differences at verse 5, but again, remarkably similar kinds of a repetition, you could say. Well, isn't that curious? The fool says in his mind or heart or concludes, God doesn't do anything. All these wrong things going on, I've done them, other people do them. I haven't gotten caught, either do they. Evidently, I'm going to keep on doing it. Perhaps that kind of mindset is warned against here. Perhaps it was prevalent in the early days of the monarchy, and it's continued unabated to be a serious threat. Psalm 53, then, is a national warning. When we live with this kind of rampant individualistic materialism mode, it's very precipitous, very dangerous to ourselves and to others. A repetition of the fool says in his heart, so it's got to be there for a reason. You can come up with a convincing theory. Psalm 54 features a cast of characters called the Ziphites. I once preached in another country on Psalm, on the Ziphites, rather, and it didn't go very well. Probably because I was just, you know, it. Psalm 54 talks about the Ziphites, of course, who choose a particular ally in the royal court and are all in on this particular candidate. the Ziphites almost become a cautionary tale, a reminder of problems that can come from internal friction and dissent. And if you don't believe that that's possible, then you've never been part of a very, very vicious church split. If you have, then you'll know full well who the Ziphites are, what they represent, and how they seem to flourish in every age of the people of God. Lastly, in this podcast, Psalm 55, just a couple of words. There seems to be lawlessness and strife in the city, and it prompts the poet to want to flee. You know, harder than a corrupt society is probably dealing with the betrayal of a friend. And Psalm 55, my goodness, listen to my prayer. Please, God, my thoughts trouble me. I'm in stress. The voice of the enemy, the stares of the wicked, they're bringing down great suffering on me. They revile me in their anger. The New Testament says, cast all your cares on him, for he cares for you. And I'm wondering if they are appropriating the powerful prayer of the poet of Psalm 55 in that particular admonition. I suspect they might be, and a good thing and a wise thing for all of us to consider. A few thoughts then on the first half of Book 2 of the Psalter. We'll pick it up next time. Meanwhile, richest of blessings as we continue our journey together.
So you thought you had to keep this up, all the work that you do. So we think that you're good, and you can't believe it's not enough. All the walls you build up are just glass on the outside. So let them fall down. There's freedom